Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest, Maris Thompson, is currently an associate professor of education at California State University, Chico. Before beginning her career in higher education, she taught English as a second language in Portland, Oregon, and Oakland, California, and even in the Galapagos Islands, Ecuador. She has lived in Northern California for 17 years, but her roots are in the German-speaking Midwest, so the research she did for a book on immigration touched her personally. She is the granddaughter and daughter of members of this community. Her book examines narratives of immigration and language loss from the German-American Midwest, especially in southwestern Illinois. Maris Thompson, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy.
Now, I'm curious that you grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and yet you came out here to California, and your doctorate is from UC Berkeley.
Right. Yeah. I taught high school in Portland, Oregon, which is what drew me out to the West Coast. So then I came down to Berkeley to start graduate studies. Yeah, so I've been on the West Coast now 20 years.
But then how did you make it to the Galapagos?
Well, it was an overseas teaching experience, you know, and these are sometimes pretty arbitrary in terms of how they all work out. So,
it wasn't necessarily because you spoke Spanish?
Well, I requested a Spanish-speaking country placement. And the program I went over is called World Teach. It was run out of Harvard School for International Development. So it was for credentialed teachers that wanted to teach overseas. And the placements were mostly in terms of South America. They were mostly in Ecuador at that point. I think there was a few that were in Argentina. And the ones in Ecuador, there was a small print on the application that said some of the placements are actually in the Galapagos Islands. So please indicate if this would be of interest. And I indicated with big exclamation points, yes, please. And so that's where they sent me.
Well, actually, you and I have in common the fact that we taught English as a foreign language to Spanish speakers. Yeah. I happen to have been in Peru, but a thoroughly enjoyable experience because they're so motivated.
Absolutely. I mean, just working with, I think, immigrant students in general has really always been my, you know, kind of my life's work and the things that interest me most as I think about the immigration journey.
Well, that's what your book that we want to be talking about is about immigration. And your title is Narratives of Immigration and Language Loss. And you call it Lessons from the German-American Midwest. So people listening might think, well, that happened in the Midwest. There was no anti-German feeling out here in California. Is that true, Maris?
Well, no. I think, you know, the Midwestern periods of anti-German sentiment were some of the most intense, especially in the urban Midwestern cities like St. Louis and Cincinnati and Milwaukee and Minneapolis. But there were many experiences in parts of California that, you know, had periods of anti-German sentiment. And things that I discuss in the historical chapter of the book talk about things like the changing of town names, street names, I mean, sort of almost outlandish or ridiculous things. Like
from our point of view now in the 21st century.
You know, people have heard maybe that the term German measles even was changed to Liberty measles during the First World War. Or French fries was changed to, you know, Liberty fries. I mean, these kinds of things were very symbolic. But on the other hand, I think they had real, very personal and very painful consequences for the communities that were living in those areas. So I think in California, we were just talking about our toys, right? You know, and that
yes,
was originally
fact,
Germantown.
It isn't in your book, but yeah. I learned that its original name was Germantown.
Yes.
And then along comes World War I, and, well, we're going to name our town after a French province.
Right, right. So there were all of these ways that anything with an associated German name or you know, public expressions of German language were really sanctioned or outlawed or made to feel, you know, made to be very unfavorable and associated with things that were unloyal, un-American.
Well, I lived in a large city for a few years, and the suburb was named Germantown. It didn't happen to get its name changed, but I learned in the Midwest that was the case.
Yeah.
Now, you dedicate your book to three women, And who are these three women that you dedicated your book to?
My grandmother, Melba Schaefer, who grew up in one of the communities in the counties where I interviewed participants, and her sister, Alice Wasmuth, who was a mentor to me as a young child.
Your great aunt?
Yes, my great aunt. My mom was an only child, so my great aunts and uncles were a big part of my family. And then also my father's mother, Emily Stewart, who I never met. She passed away before I was born.
And certainly before your book came out. Mm-hmm. Now, your mother actually helped with the research for this book. How did she help you?
Well, my mother is also, like my grandmother, maternal grandmother, is from one of the towns in these communities. So I conducted research in the area for about a year and a half. It was an ethnographic study. I was living in the field or in the communities for about 4 days out of the week. And then my mother lives in St. Louis, so I would spend the weekends with her there and do everything from download the audio recordings or the video recordings in many cases. And then I would also ask her to come out with me to the field a lot, when I call it the field. And this is the community where she was born and raised. And in a lot of ways, as she saw it, she had sort of escaped to St. Louis. She's an artist. She went to college, fortunate enough to go to college in St. Louis, and really started her life there and raised my brother and I there. So in many senses, she has kind of a complicated relationship to these German communities. And she was very helpful in going back and tracing some of the places where she was born and remembered as a child.
My guest is Professor Maris Thompson, and she has compiled narratives of immigration and language loss from the German-American communities in the Midwest. And you mentioned that your mother helped out with this, and you did this research, that you had a personal connection with this group. And when I was reading your stories, a lot of it, I was shocked. Because you're very, I mentioned the title of your book, but the introduction even says something we weren't supposed to know or hear. And I thought, well, gosh, I certainly didn't know some of these things. And I suspect that people in these very communities did not know this because they weren't supposed to know or hear it.
Yeah, that expression, I actually at one point really wanted that to be the title of the book, because it was almost like this coda or this refrain I kept hearing from the people I interviewed, that when I asked whether German, they grew up in a home where German was spoken when they were children, they would say, yes, but only when our parents were telling us or telling each other something they didn't want us to know or hear.
Using it as code,
and that's a really important metaphor that I use in the book, actually, the notion that the language became, during the periods of anti-German sentiment and feeling, really it became a secret language. And in a lot of ways, you would think that the privacy of the home would be the place where a lot of people would maintain the language and feel some sense of protection. But in some families, like my grandmother's, overnight, my great-grandfather came home and said, there will be no more German spoken in this home. So there were also a lot of voluntary restrictions that people placed on their own families because of fear, really, that they would be stigmatized in the community, that they would be harassed, or their children would be harassed in the schoolyards. So there was this real sense of, for some families, you had to voluntarily protect your children. And so there were these great stories, but sad stories, of dinner table conversations where the parents are code switching into English or into German from English, and the kids trying to figure it out. And then these elderly participants that I'm talking to are telling me these very clear memories of being five or six with their large families and all their siblings gather around the table, and you know how they were trying to deduce what the words meant. And
Well, as I'm reading these, I know that you are recording. I know audio recording, but I'm glad to hear that you have video recordings, because some of these questions that you ask, I just imagine their body language told you a lot.
Oh, absolutely.
That you couldn't capture with just an audio recording.
Yes.
Do any of these instances come to mind that you captured on videotape or video, digital, I'm assuming,
yeah.
What their body language was communicating to you?
A lot. I mean, the video wasn't just it was a huge, a really important tool in understanding how comfortable people felt with the content of their stories. And I think in one sort of memory that I have, and that I was one of the oldest participants I interviewed, Anna, I think her...
A 93-year-old, yes. I remember, because I thought, wow, 93.
Yeah, she was unbelievable. She was sharp as can be. And she actually was the only person who reached out to me directly and said, I have some stories to tell you about German heritage in the area. She was a former teacher, so we bonded over that. And I do know that when I started to initially ask about German history and what she knew in the area, that these were... She told me a lot of stories that were these kind of celebratory accounts, right? These things that, these are really the stories that they wanted to tell. The story of emigrating from Germany, of her father, of becoming successful as a farmer. And yet when then I tried to push a little further about the anti-German time period and any experiences her family had with that, she definitely stiffened. Yeah. And the eye gaze went from me to the floor, to the ceiling. And she really, I turned off the tape recording. I told her that we didn't have to continue, you know. And off the tape, she shared that this was just very uncomfortable. And I asked her if I needed to come back, and she said no. And I think she made some coffee, and we took a little break. And then when we returned, she began to share some stories that I think she hadn't anticipated sharing. And she did so. And those were the stories of her father's brothers coming over and facing a lot of discrimination at the immigration station that they came through in New Orleans. And also the fact that her father was a German immigrant and her mother was German American. Born in the United States, so had citizenship. So during World War I, when there were questions around the citizenship status of the German immigrants, I think at one point she talked about a postmaster, the postal worker who came by and was asking to fingerprint all of the non-citizens.
You said she cried when she had to tell that.
She got so emotional. And it registered all over her. Yes, and she became very, very emotional. And if I hadn't had the video recording, I think I wouldn't have been able to really consider all of those what we call non-linguistic or extra-linguistic or paralinguistic information that communicates how not only people are telling the stories and what they're sharing, but how difficult the actual process of sharing them is.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll continue my conversation with my guest, Maris Thompson. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Today, we're listening to immigration stories, past and present, and I'm back with my guest, Maris Thompson, who researched Narratives of Immigration and Language Loss, Lessons from the American Midwest. As I was reading your book about how people remembered, oh, this was wonderful, and they didn't necessarily want to talk about what was not so wonderful, because as a professor... here at Chico State who wrote a book about World War II, because our memories of World War II, everybody was happily married, everybody was for the war effort, and they worked for that, we worked together. And he went back and looked at statistics like divorce rates, and rather than listen to the stories, selective memories, he actually looked at the statistics, and it painted a different picture. So you had to keep with patience, keep asking somebody till they relaxed enough or felt confident enough or trusted you enough to tell you not just the happy things they wanted to remember, but the difficult things that they didn't want to remember.
Yeah, and that's the trick, right?
Well, what I'd like you to do, if you'll, at the very opening of your introduction, if you'll read that little paragraph there, this is the person speaking is Louise. She's 87, and she's describing the experiences of her father, who was a German immigrant, during a period of heightened anti-German feelings during World War I. What does she say?
Okay. So people in the States didn't like Germans because of that war and the Kaiser, and so they hated him way back then. Well, that seems so far and away and, you know, and stuff, but my dad lived it and knew it. So, you know, he just kept his mouth shut. But when my mom or dad, of course, I don't remember, but they would say it ended up after Elmer the first year had problems in school, they decided they wouldn't speak German anymore, only when they didn't want us to know what they were saying.
This is Maris Thompson reading from her book, Narratives of Immigration and Language Loss. And she has just quoted one of the women that she interviewed, Louise, who was 87. And this experience, you say in your book, the experience of German Americans from the American Midwest during the first half of the 20th century highlights a period of history largely unknown or certainly unspoken of in today's classrooms or public debates about immigration. And I tried, as I was reading your book, to remember anything that I learned in my classrooms about this. Zero. Mm-hmm. Nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, you read about how glorious World War II was or World War I was and how we were the good guys. And we are told nothing about the horrors. Now, you recount in your book something that's rather exaggerated. Not exaggerated, maybe. But maybe just not. It's an extreme example, for example, of what happened. But you say in your book, debates about immigration are often undergirded by a muddy awareness of immigration history for many who identify as members of a dominant culture. So those of us in the dominant culture don't always have an awareness of the true immigration history. I mentioned that you recount in your book a rather extreme example of what happened. And so I'm going to ask you to read the story of an immigrant named Robert Prager.
On the night of April 4th, 1918, an angry, drunken mob assembled outside the home of Robert Prager, a German-American mine worker from Collinsville, Illinois. The mob accused Prager of being a German spy who had plans to dynamite the mine where he worked. They demanded he come out and demonstrate his patriotism by kissing the American flag and singing the Star Spangled Banner.
Excuse me, Maris, but this you mentioned this a couple of times, so he was not the only one
right.
That they used this criterion to say, okay, prove your citizenship by, or your patriotism. Prove your patriotism by kissing the American flag and singing the Star Spangled Banner. Mm-hmm. So that's what they ask of this guy. Okay, and so then you tell us his background.
So Robert Prager was born in 1886 in Dresden, Germany, and he emigrated to the United States in 1905 at the age of 19. He was visually disabled and drifted through a number of low-paying jobs before moving to the area for work in the coal mines. He was an avowed socialist and showed strong patriotism for his adopted country, attempting to enlist in the Navy, but was rejected for medical reasons. By the time he found work in a Maryville coal mine 4 miles west of Collinsville, the area was engulfed in a wave of anti-German hysteria, where German spies and sympathizers were thought to be everywhere. A rumor was started that someone stole dynamite from the mine. A couple of miners came under suspicion, but Prager's German background made him the most suspect. He was unmarried, disabled, and an able speaker of German, all markers of someone who could not be trusted. Worse yet, He was a German immigrant in the United States a year after U.S. entry into World War I.
So this guy that just happens to be of German background is being accused of being unpatriotic. And so here's this mob outside his home, and he's trying to tell him, no, I'm innocent. You quote him, brothers, I'm a loyal U.S. working man, he told them. But this only fanned the crowd's fury. And then what did they do to him?
Well, they gathered in the jail where he was being held.
Well, you say they dragged him into the street.
And they dragged him into the street.
And draped a flag over him.
They continued. Do you want me to keep reading?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So this time, let's see. The crowd, now a parade of town residents and police, forced him down the street toward the city limits. When they reached the limits of their jurisdiction, the police stopped and said they could do nothing more for him. Prager was questioned repeatedly. Are you a German spy? Who else is mixed up with you in this business? Exhausted and surrounded, Prager only asked to write a final letter to his parents in Germany. He wrote, Dear parents, I must, on this fourth day of April, 1918, die. Please pray for me, my dear parents. This is my last letter and testament. Your dear son and brother, Robert Paul Prager.
You know, when I'm reading this, Maris, that he's writing a farewell letter to his parents because he realizes, he says, that he's going to die. But I was hoping as I was reading this, oh, no, please, please let this letter not have to be delivered, not let this be true, because I couldn't believe they would actually go through with this. But you said after he handed off his letter, he made a final prayer in German and then walked unassisted to the tree where the crowd and noose hung waiting for him. His final words were, all right, boys, go ahead and kill me. Wrap me in the flag when you bury me. And he was hanged at 12:30 on Friday, April 5th, 1918. They hanged this poor innocent man.
Yeah. And this is one of the most extreme cases, certainly, of anti-German fervor or sentiment. But the point I make in the book is that it had occurred in Collinsville, which is about 30 miles from the communities that I interviewed. And I think it exacerbated a lot of the feelings with the increasing hostility toward German language and heightened levels of scrutiny that the communities were feeling that they were being subjected to. So when I asked people about the Prager lynching and if they had any memory of that, a lot of people told me they didn't remember that. But I have a feeling their parents certainly did and were aware of it. And so back to that question or that story about prohibiting German in the homes, I think this was very much for a lot of families a reaction to the news that they were hearing and this climate of increasing suspicion that they were falling under.
It reminds me of how we Californians don't want to hear what was done to the Native Americans in this state. Mm-hmm. We've tried to cover that up. Mm-hmm. It's coming out. But here's where people don't want to talk about something like this because I don't think they want to admit the cruelty that went on during this period of time in World War.
Yeah, I mean, I think that these particular communities in the Midwest, and I definitely address this in the book, you know, there is a real both a tendency to remember and a tendency to forget. And this goes on with any process. I mean, generally, it's sort of like if you liken it to, it's analogous to taking a photograph. People don't photograph death. They don't photograph divorce. So they certainly don't generally readily rush to tell stories of trauma or distress. In particular cases of memorialization or, you know, trying to bring to justice, there may be those important efforts to do that. But otherwise, I think we generally don't feel comfortable sharing difficult stories. And I think for these particular stories for German Americans, whose descendants now very much identify as white, the idea of talking about a time when Germans were marginalized or disadvantaged as immigrants or suspected of being disloyal and not good patriotic Americans because of their ethnicity is a story they would just as soon as forget.
And yet, and you bring out this point in the book, people may know this, that in the United States today, more people claim German ancestry than any other single ethnicity, roughly 40 million people, according to the last census. And yet, in spite of this, there's so much unknown
right.
about our history.
Right. There. It's a giant shared story, and yet very many people don't know it.
My guest is Maris Thompson, and we were talking about her book that contains narratives of immigration and language loss. These are lessons from the German-American Midwest. And these people left, these immigrants, left their native country, and it was not an easy crossing the Atlantic. And so why would people leave Germany? Why did they leave Germany? What did you learn?
There were many, many reasons. I mean, I looked at most of the historical scholarship during the time period, and in the particular what we call the second wave of German immigration, which really began in the 1880s, a lot of it had to do with a series of economic recessions. And I think for farmers, especially in Bavaria and southern Germany, where most of the people in southwestern Illinois emigrated from, there were changes to inheritance laws that affected how farms were passed down in families. And that, along with some other reasons, were, I think, the primary motivations, what we call sending factors or push factors, that led a lot of German immigrants, mostly Catholic German immigrants, to the Midwest.
Well, you used the label permissive period because before the war, they could be schooled in German. Nobody thought anything about it, this minority language schooling. And so why did you call this the permissive period?
Well, this is actually a term that a number of linguists and language policy scholars, historians as well, will debate. But essentially, prior to World War I, there were, I think, in the larger consensus of scholars that I read, there were a number of foreign language instructional programs that were going on across the United States. German was one of many. There were programs in Italian. There were programs in French. Parochial school systems were the ones that primarily were teaching in these more bilingual kinds of school programs, and public schools were desperate for students. So they figured out pretty quickly that if they started to offer dual language instruction, that they could attract a lot of these immigrant children to their schools. St. Louis had a German-English bilingual programming across many schools within the district for almost 45 years. Cincinnati for 40 years. So bilingual schooling or minority language schooling is really the history of education in the United States. But then after that World War I sort of time period, this permissive period came to a pretty abrupt end.
In fact, in your book, you say the outbreak of World War I in Europe meant many things for German communities in the United States. Many German Americans hoped to see the United States stay neutral in the conflict and avoid entering the war. For some, the war resurfaced longing for the homeland, so there was hope that if the United States did enter the war, it would do so on the side of Germany and the Central Powers. Now, this is kind of surprising because we just assume, well, the United States is always going to be an ally with England. England was the enemy of the United States. We fought wars against England, and we're thinking, though, some of the Germans that the German language newspapers and a few vocal groups spoke out on behalf of Germany and against the Allies. Mm. But such views were not representative of the majority of German Americans. Ultimately, most German Americans remained torn about the war and the best way forward. The national climate was also ambivalent about U.S. involvement in the conflict. The whole United States, United States had fought two previous wars against England and had lost countless lives during the Civil War. So our former enemy is who most people are saying, well, let's get in on the side of the English and against the Germans.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people also don't realize that there was, in that time period of World War One, of kind of entering into that conflict, many Americans were very ambivalent about entering into the war and getting involved in general. There was a fairly isolationist period, and I think public sentiment was strongly, in many cases, anti-war up to a certain point. And the German immigrants and German Americans felt similarly, although they had some real personal, obviously, stake in denouncing the war against Germany. So I think initially many German groups that did come out in favor of supporting Germany or supporting neutrality, actually, is the way it was often phrased, that quickly, when they began to realize that that put them in some jeopardy of being considered non-patriotic, and that was probably not the best course of action.
My guest is Maris Thompson, and she has written a book about immigration in the United States, Narratives of Immigration and Language Loss, specifically in the German-speaking Midwest. There's a picture, Maris, in your book of this lady holding a young girl. And when I first glimpsed the picture, I thought, oh, that's Maris. And then I saw, oh, but it's 1943. You really look like your mother.
Yeah.
That was your mother being held by your grandmother.
Correct.
A lovely photograph.
Yeah. I had a real difficulty with photographic permissions in publishing the book. I took a video, but then I took stills of the video, and I asked people for permissions to share their photos in a lot of publications, and people dutifully signed off on these elaborate consent forms. But for the publisher, that wasn't enough. They needed something that said that they gave me permission for this particular book with this particular publisher. So in that case, I was forced to use my own family photos.
I noticed that was the case. And went,
Yeah.
So there was a legal reason that
right.
You had that lovely photo of you and your mother and her mother.
Yeah. But it, in many ways, made the book a lot more personal. And I appreciate that now.
Well, when you're interviewing these people, you mentioned that sometimes they didn't want to talk about, they just wanted to talk about the nice stories. They didn't want to talk about these hidden stories, these taboo subjects and stories. And so sometimes you'd have to interview somebody for quite a while. You mentioned that some of them went on for more than a couple of hours. And they would, it sounds like they would deny it at first, these troubled experiences. Well, not in our town.
Right. Yeah. This was a truly challenging interview experience for me. And I was fairly new at this whole thing as well. I think getting people to talk about the more difficult stories was helped by the fact that I had family connections in the area.
So you, in a sense, were a little bit of an insider, not totally an outsider.
Not totally an outsider. Definitely an outsider in many senses, in most. But I did have this small leverage as an insider. My grandmother knew the towns. I had spent there. I had spent time in the county as a young girl. And I actually lived with a family friend for the year and a half that I was collecting research. So I definitely would massage that. When we would meet, we would talk about how we were connected potentially, how they might have known my grandmother, who was very active in the local church.
Because when you were younger, you used to go to these communities.
I did.
You'd go visit there.
I spent summers there a lot when I was growing up. And that helped. And certainly it helped that I was living with a local family for the time that I was there. And I would attend family reunions, church picnic dinners, anything that would give me more connection to the local community and opportunities maybe just to speak informally with people and build trust. I mean, that is sort of the ethnographer's primary directive when you first arrive in a site. But in this case, for me, my positionality as a part insider allowed me to build on those connections and build a sense of trust. That said, even in some interviews, there were moments where it was clear that I wouldn't be able to continue with this person. The content of the questions elicited too much discomfort, or comments like, why do you want to bring up all that stuff?
And well, you use a phrase that I thought, yeah, I can just see this. You use the term noisy silences.
Mm. Yeah, that's Charlotte Lynn's term. She's a sociolinguist and a friend. And she does a lot of work on institutions and how they remember. She's a narrative scholar as well. And she looks at sort of the stories that are in the room, although no one wants to talk about them, you know. And I think in many senses, the silences around particularly the harassment or the language sanctioning, you know, being harassed by neighbors sometimes for speaking German in the street or over the telephone or in the church. These were very painful experiences for families. And it was clear even that there was shame in talking about them still for some narrators who were in their 80s or 90s. When I think about the decades that they had carried that kind of discomfort and shame. So I backed off in those cases. In many cases, it was clear we wouldn't continue. In other cases, I came back a different day. And maybe it was just a matter of building more trust and rapport over time. And I really tried to be sensitive and to balance this a respect for people's privacy and certainly their decision whether to disclose or not, with the need for others to know, for getting the stories out, especially as we think about our current climates of anti-immigration today. There just seemed to be so much public value in helping to unearth some of the stories that were painful for people to talk about.
Well, speaking of immigration today, this new wave of immigration currently is impacting these communities, and so you could hardly not ask them about this, and yet you do it tactfully. You don't. You kind of an open-ended question, so they were free to talk about their feelings and not to pick up on what you were trying to get them to say about this. So, for example, there's a lot of talk of the undocumented immigrants in the United States today, but there were undocumented Germans who, in one case you mentioned, they lived here 11 years before they became citizens.
That's right. Yeah, there were many, many cases as families would share family albums with all of these important documents, and I did some archival research, certainly on census records that include, you know, foreign-born and citizens. And I started to do some play with those numbers, and it was clear both in the personal anecdotal stories and the personal collections of family immigration records with the archival research that many in the community were undocumented, sometimes 10 or more years, 10, 15, sometimes 20 years. So I think that's a great point, because for many European Americans, the experience of, you know, immigrating here and settling and managing to learn the language, it took time. It takes time. And the citizenship process, for those who are unfamiliar, costs money. And
in fact, you mentioned it was rather humorous how they got through. The customs agent says, well, you have to have $10 if you're going to come in the United States. So here was this family. And how did they get in if they didn't have the $10?
That's right. Well, in the case of Anna's family, they just passed it back and forth between the brothers.
So the first brother gets the idea, oh, okay, here's $10. And so the customs agent waves him through, and he passes that back to the next brother, who says, here's my $10. Okay, you can go through. And so some of their stories about coming to America are stories of how they were clever, how they figured out how they solved problems, and how successful they were. That's what you heard a lot of, how successful these new immigrants were from Germany.
Yeah.
And then, of course, now there's an immigration of a different sort, and you get their impressions on that. And what did they say about this new wave of immigration?
Right. So in these communities today, you know, like many rural parts of the Midwest, immigration is continuing to shape and change the demographics in the area, as it always has. And the newest wave of immigrants are mostly Latinos. They're Mexican and Central American immigrants, and they're moving in to take advantage of the work in the agricultural industry and commercial nurseries, meat processing.
So these immigrants that have a family history of immigrants themselves are now having to face a different kind of immigration. Your book has so many interesting details and facts and will stimulate our thinking about this whole subject of immigration. Thank you, Maris.
You're so welcome, Nancy. It was a pleasure.
Maris Thompson's book is Narratives of Immigration and Language Loss, Lessons from the German-American Midwest. I'd also like to thank my first guest, Maris Thompson. Her book is Narratives of Immigration and Language Loss, Lessons from the German-American Midwest. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll be talking to my guest, NPR journalist Tom Gelton. He has written a book, A Nation of Nations. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest has written a book that is a major contribution to the ongoing discussion about immigration in America. Veteran journalist and author Tom Gelton has won awards reporting for National Public Radio. Over a 30-year career as a correspondent for NPR News, he has covered wars in Central America, the Middle East, and the former Yugoslavia, as well as major national stories in the United States. He is a regular panelist on the PBS program Washington Week. Tom Gelton's reporting from Sarajevo was the basis for his book Sarajevo Daily, A City and Its Newspaper Under Siege. He then wrote Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the biography of a cause. And now his newest book has just been released. A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story, is part political history, part intimate social narrative, part economic and cultural analysis. Tom Gelton, welcome to North State Public Radio.
Nancy, it's good to be with you.
Until I read your book, I had no idea the impact of an act in 1965 on our country that I wasn't even aware of. What was the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act?
Well, you just explained, Nancy, why I wrote this book. This is a law that deserves far more attention than it has gotten. And to tell you the honest truth, 3 years ago, I didn't know about this act either. I think this can be ranked as one of the most monumental pieces of legislation of the 20th century, in the sense that it is largely responsible for the demographic transformation of American society over the last 50 years. So on the one hand, I wrote it simply to bring attention to this law. But secondly, I think that transformation has raised really interesting questions about America. You know, what does it mean to be an American? What is the idea of America? You know, the incorporation of people from such different backgrounds that has resulted from the passage of this act has presented us with a situation where we're actually able to explore that. You know, we had very cliched ideas, I would say, 50 years ago about what it meant to be American. Now we've been forced to really explore this question of national identity and character in a way we had not before.
Oh, yeah. I found myself asking myself those questions. Well, this act upsets some conservatives today. Why are they upset with this act?
Well, it brought in people of a different color. And I hate to say it, but, you know, I think there are some people in any society who are uncomfortable with people of different colors than themselves, people of different religions. We have a notion that America is perhaps, if not exclusively a Christian nation, then certainly a Judeo-Christian nation. So what does it mean then when you start bringing in people who aren't part of don't have a Judeo-Christian heritage? There are people who are going to be upset by that, people who think that we need to preserve our Judeo-Christian heritage. And part of preserving that would be to give priority to immigrants who reinforce that heritage. I think that's one aspect of the criticism. The other one doesn't have so much to do with the quality or the character of the immigrants, but how many immigrants are coming in. This act, by changing the rules that governed our immigration policy, opened the door to a lot of new people coming in. I mean, there are new categories of people coming in now who couldn't come in before or would have had much more difficulty coming in before. You know, now we have visas set aside for the brothers and sisters of naturalized U.S. citizens. That's a new phenomenon. Parents and children of naturalized U.S. citizens can basically come in on an unlimited basis. There are a lot of changes that were made in 1965 that have resulted in a bigger quantitative, more numbers of immigrants. And you know, that is a controversial issue.
And before 1965, most immigrants looked like me. My ancestors were from Northern Europe. And yours also. In fact, you start your book with your own family history. And we don't know it's yours. You start out with this family farm in Norway. And then we learn that that was your ancestors. So this is one, another thing I like about your book is you tell personal stories that allow us to see, there's the impact of this Immigration Act.
Right. And, you know, one of the reasons that I tell my own story, Nancy, is not that I regard it so as so significant, but what I learned and you're right. I mean, in 1965, when this act was passed, 9 out of 10 immigrants were coming from Europe. So you and I aren't all that unique in that regard. Mm-hmm. But what I found interesting in exploring the history of my own ancestors coming to the United States is that the forces that drove their decision to migrate weren't all that different from the forces driving the decisions of people to migrate today. My ancestors came from Norway. The reason that my grandfather came from Norway was that there was nothing for him to do. There was no opportunity for him in Norway at the time. He lost the family farm. There were no jobs. He didn't really feel that he had a choice but to migrate. That is exactly the situation that may face some peasant from Guatemala today or somebody from sub-Saharan Africa. The forces that pushed people to leave their homeland have been largely consistent throughout history. And I wanted to emphasize that continuity because there is, unfortunately, some idea that perhaps that, you know, there are good immigrants and bad immigrants or good immigration and bad immigration. And somehow the notion that, you know, your or my ancestors had more defensible reasons to leave and come to the United States than immigrants today have. Basically, it's one continuous story.
Well, you describe a naturalization ceremony. Let me just go to that scene in a high school. And I was surprised to hear how that ceremony was conducted. Would you describe that for us?
Well, in the first place, it was big. There were 500 people who were being naturalized at that time. So when you've got this many people, you obviously can't administer the oath of citizenship on a one-by-one basis. So you have someone up on the stage who leads the group in reciting the oath of citizenship. One of the things that I found interesting was that before they did that, they read out a list of the countries from which those immigrants had come and were being naturalized. And they asked the people to stand up when they heard their country named. And the roll call of countries was very impressive because the vast majority of countries were ones from which it was very hard to emigrate before 1965. As I recall, I don't have the book in front of me right now, but I think the three top countries were like Pakistan, Ethiopia, and India, maybe something like that. None of those countries were ones that were allowed to send very many immigrants to the United States before 1965. So looking out on that group of naturalized people being naturalized as U.S. citizens, you saw women in headscarves, hijabs. You saw men in skull caps. You saw faces of many different colors, and it was just a very vivid scene of how the sort of the character of America's immigrant population has changed.
Well, and then we wonder, these immigrants who become American citizens, are they going to genuinely embrace our American ideology?
Well, it depends on how narrowly you define that ideology. I mean, if you define that ideology as sort of incorporating Judeo-Christian religious traditions, maybe not. I mean, the largest single group of immigrants coming into the country today are Asian. And many Asian immigrants, while many are Christian, there are many who come from either a Buddhist or a Hindu tradition. You have one of the fastest growing immigrant groups in the United States today are immigrants from Muslim majority countries who are Muslim by their faith tradition. So if you define that American ideology in those kind of semi-religious terms, no. The answer is no. But if you define that American ideology as believing sort of in individualism, if the idea that you can advance on the basis of your own individual merit, if you subscribe to the freedoms enshrined in the Bill of Rights, if you believe those, if you believe in the U.S. Constitution, if you believe in really all the principles of American citizenship, then I think the answer is yes. There's no reason why people from different backgrounds cannot accept and embrace and incorporate that American ideology.
My guest has been NPR News correspondent Tom Gelton, and his latest book is A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. Thank you so much, Tom.
Good to be with you, Nancy.
You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.